Thank you all for coming to our noon lecture series. Dr. Katia Time teaches in art studies in research and writing and in the Department of English here at UBC. Most of her work is focused on analyzing historical Canadian writing from a rhetorical perspective. In her central research project, her past dissertation, and her current book project, she studies the written discourse of the Canadian women's suffrage movement in the late 19th and early 20th century. Dr. Time considers, for instance, questions of audience design in suffrage texts and controversies about women's genres of political activism. Another project focuses on 19th century Canadian writing about literature and how it functioned as a form of public debate and international positioning of Canadian cultural work. In her most recently begun project, together with Shirley McMillan, she investigates how writing assignments can or cannot function as agents of change in courses that focus on First Nations studies. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Katia Time.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming. I'm so excited to be here. And I want to preamble this by saying that even though I've been working on suffrage for years, I can say, since I wrote my dissertation on it, most of that work is located in Eastern Canada, because that's where most of the attention was focused. Most of the newspapers were reporting on suffrage, so most of the material is available from there. And also most of the research on Canadian suffrage has been focused on Ontario mostly. And so even though I've been thinking about this for a long time, my immersion in the details of the BC suffrage movement is actually relatively new. And I'm still in the middle of doing archival research as I'm writing another chapter for my book on the BC suffrage movement in particular. So I'm not, this research is by no means completed, and I don't have a complete full-fledged theory behind what I'm presenting today. So I'm welcoming, apologizing for whatever lapses there still are in what I'm saying, and I'm welcoming your suggestions. The suffrage movement in BC was not a political movement that garnered much international or national attention. Today, we more readily associate suffrage activism with the hunger strikes of the English suffragettes, or the March on Washington by American suffragists, or in Canada with the famous five arguing the Persons case in front of the Privy Council in England in 1929, which actually came several years after women had already won provincial and federal voting rights. There's very little about the suffrage movement in British Columbia that is remembered by anyone other than those researchers who specifically focus on Canadian women's history. One explanation for this forgetting is that the activities of the BC suffragists remained within the expectations that existed for middle-class women's political participation at the time. That in contrast to better remembered political campaigns, the BC suffrage campaign was not as innovative, radical, or exciting. I think, however, that to critique a political campaign for its lack of radicalism is to discount the amount and nature of political work which is necessary to effect change. And I would argue a large portion of that work tends to remain within accepted discursive conventions. I suggest that it is because of its relative lack of radical discourse that the BC suffrage movement allows us to think carefully about the systems of established discursive action on which all the branches of the suffrage movement relied, whether they were radical or not. To highlight why I think this way of looking at suffrage activism is insightful, I want to digress a little bit and frame this investigation with a contemporary example of political activism, the case of the recent political protests in Tunisia and Egypt. We are all familiar with the frequency with which the role of social media has been highlighted in the international reports on these democracy movements. I am in no way an expert on these countries, on their history, culture, or politics, and I want to share some somewhat lay but rhetorically informed observations on my watching the news and reading about it. So from the perspective of a scholar in rhetorical and writing studies, one of the first thoughts I had was, here we have passionate public demonstrations of civil discontent, which by happening in these places at these times are new and exciting and newsworthy, And compared to the everyday life that had gone before them, these demonstrations are certainly a very unusual and very risky endeavor in the lives of those who participated. At the same time, the form of these street-level demonstrations of civil discontent in many ways might not feel new at all to audiences outside those countries. That a group of people chooses to walk the streets, chant phrases against its current government, occupies a central square in a big city, and resists police and military attempts to remove them might in fact feel like a predictable course of action in a long line of similar events with which we are all familiar. As a result, most of the news-consuming public is probably not particularly curious about the details and logistics behind these somewhat familiar public demonstrations. Given the sense of familiarity with hearing about protests of this kind, it seems no surprise then that much of the international reporting was so eager to associate these established forms of popular political upheaval with social media as a new element, a new and even more noteworthy element than the political protests themselves. And so from my Canadian lay observer's viewpoint, the perception of these democracy movements was heavily weighted towards the role of social media. However, there are also a number of recently published in-depth articles who warn against overemphasizing the role that channels such as YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and cell phone messaging played in the organizational work that lay behind these immense expressions of political protest. These articles highlight that cell phone transmission and internet availability in these countries was highly controlled by government authorities, and that the number of users of services such as Facebook was at the very most 5 out of every 100 inhabitants, and that was in the case of Egypt and much more in all the other countries. In other words, while local users of YouTube, Facebook, and blogs are easier to contact and report on in the international press, they do not represent the majority of political protesters and don't give us a full picture of the amount of work and the kind of work done behind the scenes for us by political organizers on the ground. End of digression. To draw a connection here with reporting on suffrage activism in the early 20th century, in an earlier project, I have investigated how suffrage was reported in the political pages of Canadian newspapers. I found that the militant actions of who were actually just a handful of prominent English suffragists among a much, much larger membership of suffrage organizers appeared to be the most frequent way in which women's suffrage work was brought to the attention of the front page reading public in Canada. To be fair, I should mention that many of those same Canadian newspapers also provided a broader discussion of the political work of these same suffrage organizations on their women's pages, but not on their political pages. The attention to militancy on the political pages was almost always resulted in a critique of what were termed militant actions. And that critique was expressed in letters to the editor and in editorials in those same newspapers. As a result of those critiques, Canadian suffragists were under pressure to dissociate themselves not just from these particular political genres, I'm calling militancy here a set of political genres, but also from the entire organizations of whom sometimes just one member had engaged in militancy. That pressure to dissociate was always present as Canadian suffragists desired to learn about suffrage campaigning and for that purpose maintained contact with various suffrage organizations in other countries. So it was a tricky situation for them to try and learn details of suffrage campaigning in the broadest sense from those figures, from some of those organizations that of whom some members had been accused of militancy. So tentatively, I want to suggest there's perhaps a pattern here in that transnational and national reception, cross-national reception of social and political movements might harbor an eagerness to highlight what are perceived as new uses of genre, such as militant action newly practiced by women. So these activities that women did weren't new in themselves, but it was new that women were doing them. Or new uses of genre of political action, such as the use of Twitter feeds and blog posts to support street-level political protests. And particularly, I think this might be a pattern if these new uses or new genres can be considered radical or spectacular in some way. And so the activities of the English suffrage movement were particularly newsworthy in Canada if they were radical and militant. The famous examples of hunger striking, throwing oneself in front of a horse, slashing a painting in an art gallery. When in fact, the vast majority of English suffrage activity also relied on what by that time, I would argue, were already conventional forms of women's political activism. Such activism included repeated letter writing campaigns, many, many petitions to members of parliament, the editing and printing of suffrage journals, the writing of suffrage articles that were then submitted to mainstream newspapers and magazines, the organizing of speaking tours, international as well as national speaking tours, and the founding of suffrage societies, along with all the work that comes with that, organizing meetings, coming up with plans for action, and so on. To be clear, these kinds of genres were not entirely conventional, in that they did arouse objections and protests about how women were portraying themselves in public. They were also not wholly conventional in that it took time, took quite some political conviction for women and time to learn to engage in them and expose themselves through such public work as giving speeches. But they were conventional to the degree that there was already a decades-long tradition of women engaging in these forms of political argumentation. Women's petitions to legislative bodies, for instance, have a history going back to the US American anti-slavery movement. And women had been delivering public speeches, particularly in relation to religious issues and the temperance movement in Canada from the mid-19th century onward. My point here is that these somewhat more established genres which enabled political organization should not be underestimated, and that our desire for diagnosing new developments should not focus our attention too much on the, in most cases limited, if highly noticeable role which new uses of genre play in such movements. I want to, therefore, in this project, look more closely at the broad array of genres used by BC suffragists, particularly if these genres don't otherwise strike us as remarkable in the larger history of the women's suffrage movement. So to give you some numbers, as I said, not many of us know sort of the rough outline of the BC suffrage movement. 1873, female property owners can vote in municipal elections. That's a right that was later revoked. 1890s onward, more active activism by the Women's Christian Temperance Union and the local Council of Women, who regularly sent petitions to the legislature, either petitions or even in-person delegations to speak to members of the legislature. And members of the legislature, there was male, obviously male, members of the legislature who repeatedly brought bills for provincial suffrage in front of the House. So 1890s, the broader activism starts and it really takes off sort of around 1908. 1895, Maria Gordon Grant, one of the key organizers in BC, was elected to the Victoria School Board. 1908 is when the Political Equality Leagues were founded in Victoria and Vancouver. That organization then publishes its own journal, The Champion, from 1912 onward. And one of their most remarkable accomplishments was the 10,000 signature petition that they gathered across BC. One of the organizers, Dorothy Davis, actually traveled through BC to collect these, hold meetings, and have people sign a signature. And then it was presented in 1913. And then finally, 1917, Women's Suffrage Amendment to the Provincial Elections Act. So I've already mentioned that generally we think of a suffrage movement like the BC suffrage movement as lacking in radicalism. Another way of thinking about that is to call it conservative. And in fact, conservative has probably been one of the most repeated word choices to characterize the Canadian suffrage movement. And for good reason. I'm not here to contest that at all. But I want to spend a few moments teasing out the several different observations that might get otherwise subsumed under this label of conservative. In the process of doing so, I want to consider exempting the use of what I've called the more conventional political genres from that designation conservative, for the reasons that I have mentioned. The fact that these genres had been relatively well established and repeatedly employed by women in the past does not in itself make them less remarkable for the group of women who used them at that particular moment. So here are some of the ways in which research on Canadian suffrage has highlighted this movement as conservative. I already mentioned the deliberate and publicly enforced distancing from the more radical activities of the English suffragettes. Number two, in comparison to the US American suffrage campaign, there's also the fact that Canadian suffragists did not seem to organize truly public displays and demonstrations with the same frequency and visibility. In BC in particular, there is evidence that the suffrage organizations, they did organize some public events. For instance, stands at seasonal fairs, they displayed materials and spoke to people. They also participated in the Citizens' Carnival of Victoria and had a float there. But these are sanctioned displays that happened within the framework of a larger public event and are different from, for instance, the more out of the ordinary public demonstrations in the US, such as picketing the White House for several days and being arrested for that, or organizing a parade that exclusively focused on the issue of women's suffrage. Number three, there is the fact that arguments among Canadian suffragists were almost exclusively based on the assumption that the maternal nature of women made them different from men and gave them special responsibilities for the care of others, and that it was this maternalism which qualified women for political participation rather than a fundamental equality of rights among adult citizens, no matter what their sex, race, or gender may be. And that's not a conservatism that's unique at all to Canadians. In fact, none of these conservatisms are unique to Canadians, but it's just that Canada didn't also have its radicals the way that the US and Britain had. Number four, there is the fact that the eugenics movement was one of the origins of feminist activism, a subject which receives excellent critical examination in Cecily Devereux's study on Nellie McClung. Devereux highlights that the social betterment for which feminists advocated and for which they claimed to be especially qualified was born of an ideology of active eugenic development. It renders middle-class feminist relationships to the subjects of their charitable efforts, including other disadvantaged women, highly problematic. And number five, there is the overall lack of interest in working-class women or non-white women in campaign efforts. Irene Howard has highlighted this fact in her study of Helena Gutteridge, that's a BC suffragist as well, Helena Gutteridge, who was one of the few Canadian suffrage activists who did attempt to establish political rather than solely charitable ties with working class women in BC. And number six, not specifically related to suffrage, work by Chris Clarkson and Peter Baskerville has also suggested that the turn of the century legal reforms for which women advocated and from which they benefited were motivated by a desire for the growth and expansion of BC's white population. An increase in white women's property, domestic, and voting rights was seen as counteracting the potential that the white population might be limited in its growth. as a result of, for instance, husbands abandoning their wives and white children. So it was a reaction to economic hardship. Husbands abandoning their wives, white children being left destitute by family breakups, and the fear that colonial expansion could be limited by these kinds of developments. So women's rights that mostly benefited white women can be linked to racist attitudes towards BC's Aboriginal population and immigrant population. So what do I see as a relationship between this kind of work to my thinking about genres of political action? As I said, I want to refrain from criticizing BC suffragists' use of political genres as conservative. And rather than categorize them as non-radical, I want to highlight the practicality of the genres that they were using. These genres had a tradition. Many women had practiced with them. They had gained skill and experience as they used them repeatedly. And these genres had a very good functionality. That's sort of a term from genre studies. They were perceived as fulfilling their purposes. They were not outdated or ineffective in any way. And to a genre theorist like me, this sense that a set of genres seems highly functional at a moment in time is a highly interesting moment and sparks our investigative interest. We wonder, how have these genres become stabilized? How have they become so functional? How is their repeated use and expression of institutionalized social interactions? How does their stability function to shape the thinking of newcomers to these genres? How are they used to train new generations of users and thus also reproduce existing social structures? So in that repeated use, there is a critical element that inequalities and prejudicial ways of thinking are perpetuated. But this kind of stability has its positive features as well. Women being able to vote is a great thing. There is great value in the functionality of genres, especially since their power can be appropriated for new uses. That's not to say that genre theory is mostly interested in what otherwise might seem stagnant practices. We get just as excited when genres noticeably change and visibly adapt to changing circumstances. But to me, one of the strengths of genre theoretical investigation is that it doesn't favor questions of genres changing, disappearing, or being new over the question of ongoing functionality and adapting ongoing functionality for new purposes. So to get into a little more detail, I have two examples that I want to speak about. And as I mentioned, I'm still in the middle of archival research. One is the role of the network of women's organizations in BC at the time. And the other is exemplifying how genres are used among women to interact and network with each other. And the second example will be on women's interaction with the legislature. And I have a particular example of letters being written to the premier. So the first example, myriad interactions among women activists. I want to start with another comment about this critical work that I have just cited. Genres always function in genre sets or genre systems. They don't function on their own. A type of expression in a situation is always related to other types of expressions, and there's patterns in which they relate to each other. They're related because they respond to what has been said and done before them, and they're always addressed. They always position themselves to be responded to. Genre sets or systems are thus networks of genres that have a history of interacting with each other. We can think, for instance, of the way in which a handout that describes an assignment is intimately related to the assignments that the students then hand in, but not just to this one-way relationship between these two. There's also a number of other genres that cluster around. For instance, the student who will raise their hand in class and ask a question about the assignment is also a genre that's intimately related to the handout, as well as the email we might receive just a few days before the paper is due. So these histories of interaction between certain genres, these genre sets and clusters, it also means that within those systems, the users of these genres have a history or develop a history of interacting with each other through those genres. Genres build relationships between people. Within stabilized genre systems, there are many routine ways for people to interact with each other. When we move outside these realms of practiced interaction, we enter the risky territory of not quite knowing how to interact. We don't quite know what speech or writing to use, what to say, how to assess the responses we receive. And so middle-class suffragists, within their many political activist societies, developed an incredible amount of experience interacting with each other through various genres within and across these associations. And that also happens to the exclusion of, so wonderful as this interaction is, it happens to the exclusion of interaction with groups outside. So Irene Howard, for instance, makes that clear in the work I've already mentioned in her study on Helena Gutteridge, that these very social and experienced political organizers did not have the same amount of experience interacting with women who were not part of this practiced community of genre users. For instance, in her attempts to mobilize working class women for the BC suffrage movement, Gutteridge was frustrated by the fact that established suffrage societies were holding their meetings in the afternoons when working women could not attend, and they were holding them in private parlors organized around the ceremony of the afternoon tea. They also frequently took the form of listening to a speaker. Like, there was extensive programs that some of these organizations had. On a frequent basis, they brought in speakers. They were not always focused on political issues, these speeches. They represented a wide range of topics, and working class women did not have time for that. So they happened at a time of day and relied on this and on social practices of interactions that were not inviting to politically active working class women. I'm missing a slide. Okay, I'll do without. Don't know what happened. To give you a little more detail about these suffrage organizations, in 1942, Helen Gregory McGill, another key organizer in BC, also the first woman judge in BC, compiled a list of women's associations that were active in Vancouver from the late 1800s to the 1930s. These organizations were organized for all kinds of purposes. Many were charitable, some were patriotic, some focused on women's rights, and some on arts. They had a great deal of cross-membership, meaning that usually middle and upper middle class women were members of more than one club. Many were members of what looked like four or five clubs at the same time. As a result, they also had formalized ties with each other. So these associations had formal ties with each other. They reported to each other on their work. They collaborated in organizing events, such as hosting speakers from outside the province, organizing political campaigns for changes in laws. And once the women did have a vote, they were also cooperating in campaigning for the election of the first female MLA. One particularly interesting campaign was also several of these clubs cooperated to purchase a clubhouse for women, in which then a large portion of these clubs could house their offices and hold their meetings and organize their events. That campaign for the purchase of this building lasted for several years and came to fruition in 1926 when the women's building was opened at the Hastings Fairground in Vancouver. So McGill in 1942, she compiles this list of all the women's organizations that she that she knows of, and she's very much plugged in. So it's a pretty thorough list. There are 37 clubs on that list. And I had a list of the ones most closely associated with suffrage. Oh, there it is. It's in the wrong spot. Oops. And these are the founding years. 1884, Women's Christian Temperance Movement founded, Temperance Union founded. 1894, Local Council of Women, which is a member of the National Council of Women of Canada. 1908, the Political Equality League, and also the University Women's Club. That's a club for women who have a university education, because it's before the founding of BC, UBC. And 1909, Canadian Women's Press Club, a chapter of the Vancouver chapter of the National Women's Press Club. And 1909, also Vancouver Women's Canadian Club. In my ongoing archival research, I'm interested in teasing out in more detail the way in which these clubs interacted through genres, how their network constituted a kind of counterpublic sphere in the way Michael Werner has described it in his work on publics and counterpublics. It is counterpublic in the sense that it created its own world of public discussion. It pursued activities in a way that was deliberately focused on women, somewhat and often deliberately excluding men, working on the premise that there was no other way for women to do this kind of work in the public sphere as it already existed. At the same time, this network of clubs is also modeled after the larger public sphere and mirrors the genres of that public sphere. It published magazines and women's pages in newspapers, just like the mainstream looked like mainstream magazines and newspapers. It mirrors men's business and religious associations. And it's like the men's newspapers and associations, it's a sphere distinct from the state where critical discussion produces activism that can be directed against the ways of the state. So that's some Habermasian language here that Werner is using. My second example, interactions with the legislature, letters to politicians, in particular to the Premier McBride. I noted that in their roles as suffrage organizers, middle-class women relied on genres in which they were already quite skilled. And public letters are a genre in which they had quite some experience. Particularly when letters were used to interface with the politicians, in the legislature, suffragists used these letters in an improvisational way aimed to expand their own possibilities for political interaction. Only a very small number of Canadian women's organizations published their own magazines to report on their related activities. And the BC Suffrage League, Political Equality League is one of the exceptions. Most women's clubs and associations did not operate on that public scale, that they published their own material. For these smaller associations, I would say the letters to governmental representatives were an even more crucial part of their interaction with the political sphere. My example comes from the Provincial Archives of British Columbia, and I'm focusing here on an exchange that took place in 1908 between the prominent local suffrage organizer, Maria Gordon Grant, and Richard McBride, the premier. Grant is writing as an executive member of both the Women's Christian Temperance Movement and the Local Council of Women. She voices concerns about proposed changes to the law that would stop women from voting in municipal elections. And I have highlighted here the references Grant makes to her function as a representative of the organizations for which she's a member. On behalf of 1,000 Women of Victoria, you as our representative, meet with us Tuesday next in order that a committee of representative men and women may have an opportunity to wait upon yourself and the Honorable the Attorney General and say before you some amendments in which the interests of the province are desirable. And I've also underlined the phrase she uses to assure the Premier in the interests of the province and the committee of representative of men and women that she's even speaking even for even more people than just her associations. So she repeatedly emphasizes the many voices from that counterpublic sphere that she represents. This army of people seems to permit her a direct purchase on the Premier's time. She requests quite clearly that he delay a vote that is coming before the House and that he meet with one of her committees within the next few days. In his response, the premier informs her that the vote on the municipal election select will be delayed regardless of her letter. She then requests that the premier meet with a delegation of women who will present specific wording for the amendment that is under debate. So a very large number of men and women, not only your constituents, but those in many parts of the province have been watching with keen interest the different stages. On their behalf, I again appeal to you that in the consideration of the bill and committee of the whole, that you will consult to a modified interpretation of the word householder. I beg to leave to enclose a copy of the interpretation, which the women consider to be satisfactory and just. Here at the end, she's not just speaking anymore on behalf of the women, but makes herself a representative of the whole province and of some members of the legislature even. I should note that at the time, there were also a number of examples of Canadian women activists who were either married or closely associated with members of legislatures or members of parliament, and who used that personal relationship to politicians as a gateway to influence these politicians or even governments as a whole. And one of the members of the BC suffrage movement, Mary Ellen Smith, who was wife of the MLA, Rolf Smith, is one of these examples. So there's also personal connections that allow women, not just the mass of voices that they represent, but also personal relations that allow them to make themselves, allow them a purchase on politicians' time. And Mary Ellen Smith then also becomes the first MLA when her husband dies and women are allowed to vote in 1917. So here is the suggested wording that Grant is speaking about. The next development in the story is that the government's amendment was passed, disenfranchising women from voting in municipal and school board elections. In response to this disappointing development, Grant demands again on behalf of a large group of women that the MLAs be asked to ask questions and give their reasons for voting on the amendment, and that they do so at a public meeting. The premier and the other MLAs for Victoria refuse to attend such a meeting, and they say that they don't see how it would have any benefit. The premier also states that he will be willing to meet with any women's council delegation in the future and talk to them in his office. In terms of its stated goal, Grant's communication with McBride was quite unsuccessful. It was successful, however, in terms of being able to make a demand on behalf of two women's organizations. In the absence of the right to vote and be elected, these women did find a way here to inch as closely as they can to the process of lawmaking. And they do so insistently, proposing even a text for a bill that is in front of the House. The various genres they master in this particular attempt are very clearly recognizable as the genres that have grown with the phenomenon of civic clubs and associations. Letters sent in the name of the association, references to meetings being organized, votes being held, and resolutions being passed. I'm going to jump a little bit so I don't take up too much time. To put these letters, I have a reference here, these examples of letters to political representatives in a larger history of women's political participation, we can relate this exchange to Susan Seska's work on anti-slavery petitions that were produced in the mid-19th century US. Much like the letters I have just shown, female anti-slavery activists appropriated the genre of the petition in the absence of political rights. In other words, despite the fact that women had no political voice in front of parliaments, it was the nature of the petition as a genre and the roles that belonged to this genre which allowed them an opportunity to speak and create a relationship to parliament. Seska notes that anti-slavery petitions in particular constituted a turning point in a longer history of US women's petitioning. So petitioning by women in Britain as well as the US has a much longer tradition. But there's a new development for anti-slavery petitions, says Teske. These petitions turned from being pleas written by one person and humbly pleading this person's case in front of a sovereign to an instrument of mass democratic politics. And that's also why I highlighted all these moments when Grant speaks of a mass of people. So an instrument of mass democratic politics whereby the wording of the petition was copied onto several sheets and long lists of signatures were attached. The resolutions that are part of Grant's letters and later on the province-wide petitioning campaign that collects these 10,000 signatures follow in the footsteps of Cestus' history of anti-slavery petitions. They are genres of social movements. They represent a group's collective interaction with government officials. They create the opportunity for disenfranchised groups of people to participate in debates about federal legislation. But I also see a newer developments here in the early 20th century. These suffragist letters are different from Cesca's petitions in their tones of assurance and demands. So Cesca's examples plead much more humbly in the older tradition than these examples do. Cesca notes that in her examples, women never state their case directly. They instead begged, prayed to be heard, and those are words used in the petitions. They implied that the petitioners were unworthy of making demands and that had instead been constrained to feel by a higher power to write this petition. In contrast, Canadian women at the beginning of the century speak with firm assurance and make their demands in the belief that their right to write such letters will not be questioned. Except for the right to vote and become politicians themselves, these women, through their practice in their counter-public spheres of these women's organizations, have already carved out a public role for themselves. They have done so by learning the genres of political interaction, by establishing them within their associations, becoming proficient at them, and stylistically appropriating them for their own political purposes. Thank you.